Good morning. You're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Until last year, the North African state of Mali was seen by many as a model democracy in the region, but that changed in March after a military coup. The new government has a tenuous grasp on security in the state, especially in the northern desert region, which has become a haven for rebels, including some members of a group similar to Al-Qaeda. Earlier this year, things came to a head in Mali when France sent over troops. They've helped stabilize the government a little, but the country is still rife with human rights abuses and displacement. Our guest today is Gregory Mann. He's an associate professor of history at Columbia University, and on March 11th, he'll be at the University of Illinois for a conference titled Peacebuilding in West Africa. He's an expert on Mali and our guest this hour. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's get a sense of what it's like in Mali right now. What are the conditions on the ground in the country?
Well, it's a vast country, so the conditions are different in different places. In most of the south, life goes on more or less as normal. I should say I haven't been there in a few months now. I plan to go in a couple of weeks. I'm talking to people on the ground there, and what I hear is that things are going on more or less as normal in the south. So there's some tension and fear. The north, is very different. It's open warfare in the area in the north and the east of the country, which is the vast expanse of the Saharan Desert, but also the populated towns of Timbuktu and Gao and Kidal in the southern desert and in the area that's called the Sahel, which is just the southern fringe of the desert.
So talking about that area in the desert, we've heard a lot about sort of human rights abuses that have been happening, about serious instability. Could you tell us a little bit about the conditions there?
Well, there is very sharp fighting going on in the mountainous range in the northeast part of the country, which is not really populated. There's some fighting going on around the towns of the south, particularly the southern region of the desert, that is, especially around the town of Gao. And there have been a few attacks, effectively terrorist attacks and car bombs and that sort of thing in the towns of Kidal and Gao. So the security situation is very, very unstable, and people, of course, are afraid and anxious. There are French troops on the ground. There are Chadian troops on the ground. Of course, the Malian army is there, and there is a loose coalition of jihadi Islamist fighters and another important army another important group of fighters known as the MNLA, who are effectively Tuareg separatists who want to create a separate autonomous zone or independent state in the northern part of Mali. They come from a minority ethnic group in the north as in the south, and they are pushing for their own political agenda, which is different from that of the Islamist and to some extent aligns with those of the French army, but not with those of the Malian army. So it's almost as if you have two conflicts in one. In fact, you have many different conflicts, but you could think of it as two wars going on at the same time. One is a French-led war against the jihadi forces that have been active in the country for several years now. The other war is effectively between the Malian army and the Tuareg separatist movement known as the MNLA and their various allies. That second war is now submerged by the bigger war, the war that brought in the French, the conflict that has brought in the Chadians as well, which is aimed mostly at these Islamist fighters.
So this was not what Mali was like about a year ago by many accounts. Some people even would call it a model democracy. That's a term I heard quite a bit. Take us back. What happened a year ago that disrupted the peaceful state relatively in Mali?
Well, there are many different things going on. If you wanted to go back to 2012, you could say in this time of the year, 2012, you had a rebellion in the north led by the MNLA, which was at that time in alliance with different jihadi Islamist groups. They were winning on the ground against the Malian army, which was taking a lot of losses, and there was a great dissatisfaction about this in the south, especially in Bamako, which is the capital. That was going on from January through March of 2012. The kind of rebellion in the north, insurgency in the north, is something that Malians have seen repeatedly since 1963, so over the last 50 years. Mali became independent in 1960. Shortly thereafter, there was a Tuareg rebellion in 63 and 64, and other rebellions have happened sporadically in the 50 years since. So that war in the north was not something unknown to Malians. They weren't happy about it, but it was something they had seen before. Then what happened, and what changed the dynamic very considerably, was that the military in the south, in the capital of Bamako, staged a coup d'etat chased out the elected president, who by that time had become very unpopular, but who was going to leave office in a few weeks after presidential elections. So a coup was staged in the South. The president was chased from power. The government effectively collapsed or went into kind of a stasis in the wake of the coup. But more importantly, the army collapsed in the North. The junior officers arrested the senior officers. There was kind of anarchy in the ranks. And the alliance of the MNLA fighters, the Tuareg separatists, and the jihadi Islamist fighters were able to take over roughly two-thirds of the national territory very, very quickly. That is, the Malian army simply collapsed immediately after the coup d'etat. And that was a situation on the ground that essentially prevailed right until January 2013. That is, it's more or less a kind of, not exactly a truce, but a kind of a stalemate, lack of any real advance on the ground, where the Malian army, weakened, very internally divided, held on to the south, which is where most of the population lives. But this coalition of the MNLA and the jihadi fighters held on to the vast territory of the north, sparsely populated, but with a few important centers in which many people live, Timbuktu, Gao, Kidal especially. So that was the situation that prevailed through January 2013. Importantly, in the summer of 2012, the MNLA alliance with the jihadi fighters fell apart, and the jihadi fighters basically threw the MNLA out, pushed them aside, elbowed them aside, and took over the region themselves, effectively marginalizing the MNLA. So then we had a kind of scenario in which there was no real fighting going on between, say, North and South, between the Malian National Army and its opponents, and there was a great deal of diplomacy going on in the UN, in the Organization of West African States, known as ECOWAS, to try to figure out, should there be a military intervention, was there a way to support the Malian army, could democracy be restored in Mali, how to get the coup leaders to cede power to civilian leadership. And so there was a great amount of kind of diplomacy, let's say diplomatic work, and a great amount of political work going on to try to create the conditions for political stability in the South that would allow outsiders to engage in some way in the Malian conflict. And that's the situation that prevailed right through January 2013.
You're listening to Focus on WILL. Our guest this hour is Gregory Mann, and we're talking about the situation in Mali. If you have any questions or comments, send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. So, Professor Mann, essentially, just to summarize, what we have is kind of a military government in the South and kind of a fairly lawless North that's roughly run by these Islamist groups. Is that sort of how it's going, these jihadi groups?
Well, Things are changing very rapidly. Let me just make one thing a little more clear.
Thank you.
It is an enormously complex situation. There is now a civilian government in the South, a kind of caretaker interim government, which is not especially popular, but is nonetheless in place. It is not entirely able to exert its control over the army, so there's a kind of awkward arrangement between a civilian government that attempts to assert control over the military and a military that doesn't really want to be controlled and itself is broken into different factions. So there is a civilian government in place. It is not widely popular. It's not considered to be very legitimate, but it is the most kind of stable partner that diplomats from the outside have to work with.
Now, in terms of the North and why it's so difficult for intervention in that case, give us a sense of sort of the geography of the place. It's not as though the military can just go into the North and displace these people who've sort of taken over such a large chunk of the country, and that's largely because of geography, right?
Right. And the North of Mali is vast. I mean, this is the Sahara. It is quite large. It is larger than France, for example. It is, in fact, not sort of simple rolling kind of dunes, as one might imagine. It's extremely rugged terrain with a very significant mountain range known as the Adar. And it historically, and especially in the last few years, has been a place in which people have been able to engage in a lot of smuggling, different kinds of traffic across the Sahara, especially to Algeria and Libya through Niger. And it's also a place in which, in the past, in different rebellions and military conflicts, that mountain range has served as a kind of sanctuary for fighting groups. So it's a very difficult terrain to control. It's very hard to get across. Of course, it's not There are no paved roads. It's very difficult to get your vehicles rolling through it. It is difficult to navigate, and it's extremely tricky terrain. It requires, you know, skilled drivers and a great deal of logistical support for moving around, for example, fuel and ammunition, the kind of supplies, water, for example, that a fighting force needs in that terrain. So it's very difficult for a conventional army like the Malian army is to really take on these fighters in the north.
So that's kind of where France came in earlier this year. Is that right? France came in to support the Malian army in their attempts to sort of shore them up a little bit in the north to give them a bit more control over the region.
Well, France came in effectively to do the fighting, it has to be said. What happened in January of this year was that the Islamists began an advance on the south in a fashion that no one had quite anticipated. In other words, there was a long kind of diplomatic process at work, as I suggested, about getting together some kind of coalition to, you know, reassert government control over northern Mali. And the diplomats were acting as if they had all the time in the world, as if they were going to set the calendar. What happened was the Islamists essentially took the initiative and launched an assault in early January, January 9th, January 10th of this year. And the Malian army was on the verge, apparently, of collapse. The Malian interim president, Jean-Claude Traoré, made an appeal to his counterpart, François Hollande, the president of France, and said, you know, we need the help of the French army. France has military bases in Côte d'Ivoire, in Gabon, in Chad, etc. They don't have them in Mali itself, but they haven't had. But France very quickly intervened, sent in a small force that they quickly, you know, expanded to now about 4,000 soldiers. But it sent initially a small force with a couple helicopters and stopped the Islamist advance. January 10th and January 11th. What's happened since then is essentially that France has led the fighting along with these Chadian troops who have arrived. There are other West African troops there, part of the West African organization, but they're not actively engaged in the fighting. The Malian army has largely been on the sidelines, it has to be said. There's some dispute about whether or not they are doing some of the fighting or, in fact, are mostly there in an almost symbolic role. That they are not actually leading the assaults. And that is quite a complicated question in and of itself. There's a lot of talk also about the need for greater training of the Malian army for reasserting command and control in an army that had effectively lost that over the last several months, in fact, possibly over the last several years. And there are particular units of the Malian army that operate more or less independently, which came in also from Niger, from neighboring Niger to the east, and are engaged in some of the fighting in places like Gao and further up into the mountains in the Adrar.
So you mentioned that the North has kind of become the sanctuary for some of these fighting groups, and it's created worry in certain places that these are going to be safe havens for terrorist groups in the north of Mali, which explains part of the international concern. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, northern Mali has effectively been a safe haven for terrorist groups over the last few years, since around 2009, 2010 at least. When we say terrorist groups, we're talking about a complicated scenario. Unfortunately, everything in this scenario is more or less complicated. So the groups that are active here, are the most important of them is a group that emerges from the Algerian insurgency in the 1990s, Algeria being the, you know, country immediately to the north, holds a long border with Mali. Northern Mali is much more oriented towards Algeria than it is towards southern Mali, economically and otherwise. And the Algerian insurgency produced a hard core of fighters who were effectively pushed out of Algeria over the last few years and essentially found refuge in northern Mali, which is a big, loosely controlled space. Over the last decade, that group of fighters began to do two things. And one was to take European hostages, mostly tourists, people passing through the Sahara, to take them hostage and to hold them against ransoms that were paid by European governments and also Canada. Those ransoms were very considerable, in the millions of dollars. The other thing that that group began to do, and there's some dispute about this depending on the sources, was to effectively tax or to demand protection money for convoys that were crossing the desert, and these were quite profitable in the context of the drug smuggling, which has also become rooted in the desert over the last several years. So that primary group took the name a few years ago of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And U.S. government sources claim that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is essentially a franchise of Al-Qaeda, somewhat ideologically distinct, but nonetheless that over the last few years it has become the primary moneymaker or the most profitable franchise, if you will, of the different al-Qaeda operations. And that potentially, and this is a concern of U.S. government officials, that potentially al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb can fund al-Qaeda operations elsewhere in the world. And so that's the kind of U.S. concern. You know, when you say al-Qaeda, you get the U.S. government concern. The French government concern, and that to a lesser extent of other European governments, has been around the kidnapping of French citizens and other European citizens in the neighboring countries, in Niger, in Mauritania, in Algeria, etc. The kidnapping of these people who were held in northern Mali. So all that is to say that northern Mali has been a sanctuary for terrorist activity for the last several years, that it's been extremely profitable for those terrorist gangs, or effectively kind of criminal groups, right? And that it was perceived by both Mali's neighbors, but also by France and other European countries, this was a real danger for them.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Jim in Champaign, you have a comment on our topic today. Jim, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Jim and Gregory. Gregory, I've got a question for you. Have you ever asked a Tuareg what they like to be called?
Have I ever asked a Tuareg what do they like to be called? You know, most Tuareg would call themselves Tamashek. They might refer to themselves by the particular confederation to which they belong.
They speak, they speak Tamashek.
Yes. But, you know, the term Tuareg itself is not in any sense, you know, pejorative or unusual.
Au contraire. 32 years ago, I was told under no uncertain circumstances, I'm paraphrasing from the French, that I should never, ever use the word Tuareg. I could use the word Tamashek or Kel Tamashek, which means the people who speak Tamashek. I was actually taken aback so much that I didn't drill down as deeply as I should have. But when I checked later with other members of the Peace Corps Grapevine had it that Tamashek means the godless people. I can see it. I didn't really pursue it any further than that, but I can see clearly. I go kind of apoplectic anytime I hear the term these days. And Volkswagen even has a vehicle named a Tuareg, and I view that as quite a stumbling block. On the other hand, what an opportunity it would be to get this thing cleared up.
Well, that's an interesting comment. Let me take there a couple things in there that are quite interesting. Most. I'm going to stick with the term Tuareg. It's very widely used. I have Tuareg friends in Bamako. No one's ever objected to it. It might be that different people in different contexts have found it objectionable. I've never known that to be the case. It's used quite frequently, including in the academic writing and everything else. I've met MNLA folks who use the term. So, and then speaking the French language, you know, that's the term that is most commonly used. The Kel Tamashek is perfectly, you know, obviously acceptable as well, but ethnonyms are always, you know, the names for peoples, ethnonyms, are always a little bit complex. I would guess that most Tuareg, like most Bambara, who are Muslims, would not like to be called the godless people. The origin of the term Bambara, which is the biggest ethnicity in the country and the South, the origin of that is effectively to say, you know, people who refuse Islam, but now most of the Bambara are themselves Muslims. Regarding the question of the Tuareg term itself and how Volkswagen has used it, I mean, that's an interesting case, in fact, a little bit different from the way in which ethnonyms have been, or the names of peoples have been used, for example, by Jeep, which has a Cherokee, et cetera. My understanding is that when Volkswagen wanted to name their all-terrain vehicle the Tuareg, that they effectively hired an anthropologist who has worked for many years in the societies of northern Niger in particular, and as a kind of consultant, and then he brought in a number of people, mostly from Niger, and that there was a kind of arrangement that was made by which some of the, I don't know whether it was kind of a licensing fee or some kind of arrangement was made such that, you know, some contribution towards the general well-being of societies of northern Niger and Tuareg in particular would be accommodated by Volkswagen in order to use the name. That's my understanding. And there might be somebody who knows more about that than I do.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you very much for your call. And if you have a comment or a question about today's topic, please send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. You can also call us here 217-333-9455 or toll free 1-800-222-9455. Our guest is Gregory Mann, professor of history at Columbia University, and we are talking about Mali. Now, in terms of the conditions in the north as it's currently being sort of roughly run by these loose coalition of rebel groups, what are the conditions like there right now? What is it like to be a citizen in that part of the country?
Well, I think it's very tough. As you said in your intro, hundreds of thousands of people are now displaced. They fled the fighting in 2012, and they have not gone home, or many of them have not gone home with the fighting that is going on now. So it's been quite a difficult and long period of time for people of the north. As I say, the Tuareg people are a minority in northern Mali. There are many. It's a very diverse part of the country. There are many Sonrai people. There are many Pul people. There are Arabs and people from the southern part of the country as well. Many of those fled, as I say. Those who remained in place found themselves living under a very crude, a kind of vigilante version, a very distorted version of Sharia law in the months that followed, and they suffered a great deal in the period before the French intervention when the Islamists were effectively forced to flee the population centers. Now, of course, there's ongoing instability and insecurity in those places, and so many people have not yet chosen to return home, but of course they hope to do so.
So we've also heard stories about hospitals that have been looted, widespread raping. I mean, what do you believe have kind of been the biggest human rights violations that have been happening?
That is an extremely thorny question, and I hope not to leave out anything important here. When the alliance of the MNLA forces, that is the Tuareg separatist forces, and the jihadi forces took over the population centers of the south, there was a great deal of pillaging and looting, as you say, and a great deal of rape happened, especially in Menaka and Gao, which are towns to the extreme east, Gao being the largest of them. Those reports were quite harrowing, especially in March and April of 2012. They were extraordinarily disturbing, and that was provoking a great amount of that was provoking many people to flee. Medical centers were looted, and the supplies were taken, presumably into the Adar, into the kind of sanctuaries that the Islamist groups had carved out for themselves. But they might also have been taken to different field hospitals that the different rebel movements were trying to use. So that's the first kind of big wave of human rights violations that happened right in March and April 2012. There were, of course, over the summer, a set of reports equally harrowing of amputations and one stoning of people who were accused of violating a distorted version of Islamic law by the jihadi fighters who had taken over the desert towns. There are several, you know, very reputable organizations that have reported on these crimes, notably Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, but others as well. So you have a set of crimes committed or apparently committed by the MNLA and the Islamist fighters in an alliance, a set of crimes committed under the Islamist domination or occupation of the north, and then you have a second set, which is extremely important, or I should say a third set, which is extremely important, which is the apparent killings of people who are, in Malian terms, peau blanche, or light-skinned people, who are Tuaregs and Arabs, by the Malian National Army, notably in Sévéré and Mopti, twin cities in the center of Mali that were the heart of the offensive of January 2013. There have been several reports of people having been taken from their homes and, you know, scores being settled and whatnot, but certainly that soldiers in the Malian National Army seem to be engaged in or have been engaged in some extrajudicial killings in the last several weeks. There has not been any prosecution of those crimes, to my knowledge. There was a report by the Malian Chief of Staff that some units had been called back from the north, I think that the Malian army is quite sensitive to this issue as an important political issue. It's important to recognize that the command and control of the Malian army is extraordinarily weak, best evidenced by the coup d'etat of March and the effects going on from then. So there are human rights violations, or very serious and credible accusations of human rights violations on all sides, against the civilian population of the north by the Islamist and jihadi fighters, against the civilian population of the north by MLA fighters, and against the civilian population of the north by the Malian National Army. So it is an extraordinarily complex situation and will pose real challenges in terms of eventual truth and reconciliation and some kind of negotiations towards a rebuilding of what was once a peaceful community in the north.
Has this hit the level of a humanitarian crisis?
This hit the level of humanitarian crisis in 2012 when the people went into exile or were internally displaced. That's hundreds of thousands of people, somewhere over 400,000 people, either were internally displaced within Mali itself or fled to Mauritania, Burkina Faso, Niger, and to a lesser extent into Algeria. Many of those internally displaced people who went to Bamako, for example, are still there, but many people who were in Bamako, Tuareg people who were in Bamako, also fled, especially to Burkina Faso, because they felt threatened in the sort of poisoned political climate of the rebellion in the north and resentment against light-skinned people in the south. So the humanitarian crisis emerged in 2012. It's been partly accommodated by the UNHCR creating refugee camps. You know, they went into their kind of posture of creating camps and getting services to people as best they could. It could be said the crisis is not as grave as it was at one point anticipated that it might be. In April and May, there were great fears that there would be a famine in 2012. That famine didn't quite happen. Actually, the harvest in 2012 was quite good. The rains were good in the south. Food prices have somewhat stabilized, and things have not been as bad as at one point people feared that they might be. However, food is still expensive in the north, and there's the lack of access to medical facilities, subsequent to the destruction of those facilities by rebels last year. So it's a very difficult humanitarian situation that continues to go on, and until there's greater stability in the north and people feel safe, nobody's going to want to go home, or large numbers of people are not going to want to go home.
Well, we have to take a short break, but we'll be back in a minute with Gregory Mann, Associate Professor of History at Columbia University, and we'll continue our conversation about Mali. In the next half hour, we'll also talk about what the United States can and should be doing about this issue. That's coming up on Focus on WYLL AM 580. You're listening to WYLL AM 580. This is Focus. I'm Chris Berube, sitting in as host today. Our guest on the program is Gregory Mann. He's an associate professor of history at Columbia University, and on March 11th, he'll be at the University of Illinois for a conference titled Peace Building in West Africa. He's an expert on Mali, and we are talking to him this hour about the conflict in that state. If you have questions or comments, you can send us an email at willtalk@illinois.edu or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. You can also call us at 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So, Professor Mann, France intervened militarily. They sent in troops earlier this year to defend a government that essentially is not entirely stable, that some people still question the legitimacy of. In that regard, I mean, what was kind of France's endgame here? What did France think they were going to get out of something like this?
Well, that's a point of great debate. I think they were more clear on the immediate imperative of some form of intervention than they were on the actual endgame. And since then, I think there's been some work, you know, political work and debate within France and between France and the Malian government to think about what the endgame might be. If we go back to January 2013, what seemed to be happening was that, as I say, a coalition of jihadi forces that had been effectively terrorizing the north for the last several months was launching an offensive on the population centers of the south. It looked like the Malian army would not be able to withstand that. Nobody thought the Malian army was going to be able to withstand that. And the Malian government called for the French government to intervene, which the French then did. If you looked at a map of Mali, it would look like something like a figure eight. I mean, very crudely, like a figure eight. The one part of the figure eight, the Sahara part, is much larger than the other part. But it is more or less cinched at the waist. It is cinched at the center. It is narrower at the center. And if you think of it as kind of a belt around the center, the town of Sebre is the buckle on that belt. The town of Sebre was threatened by the Islamist fighters, and it's an important town. It's a river town, but it's also the one place in Mali, apart from Bamako itself, much further south, the capital, where there is an airfield that is capable of handling large military transport planes. So part of what happened is that the French said, if this town of Sebre and its airfield falls, any future intervention, any future military campaign is going to become extraordinarily difficult to wage. Any future engagement in terms of the humanitarian crisis and moving things into that part of the country is going to become extraordinarily difficult. And so they could not allow the town of Sebre to fall. This was sort of the immediate imperative. It was really, I think, it was more like emergency room medicine than it was like some kind of palliative care or some, you know, longer engagement. Their diagnosis at the time was that you had to make a very sharp intervention in a very urgent circumstance. That scenario is one that is, I think, pretty widely agreed upon. There was talk about the idea that the Islamists might actually take over the whole country. They could go, if they're going to make it to Sebre, they could easily roll straight onto Bamako a few hours away by road and take over the whole country. And that was an important fear of France, but also of its allies and of the Mali government itself, of course, first and foremost. The end game, though, is not clear. There are a set of different political objectives. One is that there is a terrorist threat to France, it doesn't really matter if there is or isn't, but probably more important is that France perceives the terrorist threat from Mali, either that there will be attacks in France itself, but more importantly, that there are several French people held hostage by the jihadi fighters in northern Mali. There's that question of a kind of terrorist threat that they say they want to put an end to. They want to eradicate these gangs from northern Mali. That may or may not be possible, but that's what they're in the process of attempting to do in the current campaign. The second objective that they have proclaimed was to defend what they call the territorial integrity of Mali. Remember, there's a separate movement, this MNLA Tuareg separatist movement, which wanted northern Mali to become an independent state and made a proclamation to that effect in April of 2012. Mali's neighbors, Mali itself, and most of the outside powers like France, don't want to see that happen. In fact, no country has supported this idea of an independent northern state. The French don't want to see that happen. They want to see Mali's territorial integrity preserved. There's a little bit of wiggle room in their language about this, but that is what they have nonetheless stated. So the question of assuring the territorial integrity of Mali is a long-term process. That would entail meeting some of the grievances that are expressed by the Tuareg people and by the political movement of the MNLA, which is a minority movement within Tuareg society, but nonetheless is a minority movement in arms and therefore has to be taken seriously and probably eventually will have to be negotiated with.
Well, one issue that's come up quite a bit, you mentioned territorial integrity. What we've seen is kind of other unrest happening in the region, such as in Algeria, where a number of foreign nationals were kidnapped last month. Over 30 people were killed, and it was said that it was a retaliation to what France was doing in Mali. Is there kind of a worry that if this state becomes unstable, there'll be a contamination of other states in North Africa?
Well, there are two ways to think about that. The other states in North and West Africa clearly perceive that to be the case. The Niger to the east, Mauritania to the west, Algeria to the north. In different ways, they've seen Mali in the past few years as a place where their problems, their worst kind of dangers were rooted, and where these terrorist groups were becoming strong, and that those groups might pose a threat on their own national territories. The other way to think of it is that whole broad region, if we sort of erase the idea of national boundaries, the whole sort of broad region of the Sahara, whether Malian, Algerian, Nigerian, Mauritanian, is a vast zone of exchange in which people actually move across with people with certain skill and capacity actually move across fairly easily. Large, easily might be the wrong word, but they're able to move quickly across vast expanses of terrain. There is no state or government that controls that terrain. That is why it is so propitious to smuggling. That is why it's been propitious for hostage taking and the holding of hostages against significant ransoms. And it also seems to be, from the point of view of the Islamist fighters, and the point of view at least of the sort of the propaganda or the discourse of Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb, it's a place from which war can be launched against Algeria, but also against France and what are seen as these regimes that are inimical to Islam, which is purely the rhetoric of the Islamist of Al-Qaeda Islamic Maghreb that I'm recapturing there. But they have the idea that there is a war that needs to be waged against France. They would like people to believe that France is in a war against Islam, and that they can use this territory to fight that war.
You're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Our guest this hour is Gregory Mann, an associate professor of history at Columbia University, who will be here at the University of Illinois on March 11th at a conference titled Peacebuilding in West Africa. If you have questions or comments for Professor Mann, send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. You can also give us a call here, 217-333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Now, we talked a little bit about human rights abuses and things that were happening in the country, and we actually have a listener question on Twitter from Dan asking, would you talk a little bit about the museum issues that have been happening, that there have been museums in the country that have been, I guess, kind of ransacked. There's been a lot of very valuable culture destroyed in Mali in the past couple of months. Why is that meaningful? Why is that significant?
Okay, I think your listener is referring to perhaps two things. One is the destruction by the jihadi Salafists of the tombs of saints and notables, the mausolea in places like Timbuktu, notably. And the second would be the destruction of some of the Arabic manuscript collections that were housed in Timbuktu, and especially the centers themselves in which these manuscripts were housed. The jihadi fighters are opposed to a vision of Islam or version of Islam that is old in Mali, quite deeply rooted in Mali, which recognizes a particular people as perhaps having been holier than others, as having been potentially closer to God, might be the term they would use, than others. And the jihadi Salafists are opposed to this idea and therefore destroy the tombs of those people who are considered locally to be saints. And this was happening over the summer of 2012, mostly. The second phenomenon is actually also a very interesting one, which is, The Sahara broadly, but Mali in particular, and Timbuktu especially, have been places, centers of Islamic learning for centuries, in fact, for 1,000 years. And Timbuktu in particular has served as a kind of almost a university town in Islamic terms. It has been a place to which students came from all over to study. It's a place of great renown for its calligraphy, for its jurisprudence, or its faculties of law and of the different Islamic sciences. And a number of families and other groups and communities in that part of northern Mali, but based around Timbuktu, have held important collections of Arabic language or Arabic script manuscripts, which over the last decade or so had been gathered together and cataloged, and there was a move to make them available to scholars. Some of the scholars, in fact, were working at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, working with these collections. Those collections were threatened by the jihadi fighters in the period when they controlled Timbuktu. And as they lost control of the town in the face of the French attack and they had to abandon the town, they destroyed one of the centers in which, or attempted to destroy one of the centers in which the manuscripts had been housed, and they destroyed some of the manuscripts. At first, it was reported that they destroyed all the manuscripts, which many of us thought to be unlikely. There are thousands of them, and they're somewhat dispersed. It's turned out that most of the manuscripts were hidden by their caretakers or their proprietors or those who govern these collections or own the collections in terms of individual families. And so a small amount, we don't yet know the scale of the destruction, but a small number of the manuscripts was destroyed by these people. It's a shame, both in terms of the destruction of the tombs and the mausolea and in terms of the destruction of the manuscripts, because these are considered to be part of world heritage by UNESCO in particular.
I'd like to get back a little bit to the international response, and specifically, France still has troops on the ground in Mali. They continue to say pretty optimistically that they think they'll be out, later this spring. But there's also a sense in Mali of discomfort with having France there at all, since, of course, Mali was a former colony of France. Do you get a sense that they're getting sick of having the French in Mali?
Well, that is a very difficult question. Let me say first that as an historian who's worked on Mali for a number of years, one of the things that's always been attractive to me about Mali was precisely that it's not a country in which the former colonial power has enormous sway as compared to other African countries in which France still plays an even more important role than it does in Mali. And when the French intervened in January, I was surprised at how many Malians said to me, especially older Malians who, were around in the end of the colonial period, who were very happy to see France intervene because they felt that their army wasn't capable of protecting them from this attack. So that was a sentiment expressed by many people. And I think it's still the predominant sentiment, although, as I say, there are people who have always been opposed to the French intervention, but I think had no realistic alternative to that intervention. What's happening now is that people in the north, and especially the MNLA fighters, the Tuareg separatist fighters, who, as I say, were mostly pushed aside over the summer of 2012, but who now see that with the French arrival, they can attempt to ally themselves with the French and attempt to secure their political objectives, which are essentially greater autonomy for the north, potentially even some form of national independence. The question of national independence has been mostly, I think, set aside at this point. But the MNLA fighters believe that they can serve as a kind of proxy army for France and therefore serve their own interests. They certainly do not want to see France leave. They want to see France stay, especially in the town of Kidal in northeastern Mali, which is the town which is essentially the base of the Kelidar Tuareg in particular. They think of it as kind of their metropolis, if you will, if the term is not inappropriate. And they don't want to see the Malian army enter that town. They want to see the French army continue to control it. They have every interest in France staying. I believe the Malian army itself, at least probably a part of the Malian army itself, I think is probably realistically aware of the fact that they also need the continued French support. It might be that the only people who want the French to leave very quickly are the French themselves. It might be that the French government itself does not want to keep paying the price of this long military intervention but sees no real way out. That remains to be seen.
Well, talking about an alternative, one thing that's been floated by a few people, including, politicians and speakers inside France, is the idea that, well, Mali has to take care of its own house at some point. There should be maybe even a pan-African force that is involved. Is that realistic? Is that realistically going to have any kind of influence?
There's been a lot of discussion about African force coming in and bolstering the Malian army. Obviously, the Chadians are already there, and there are some other forces from different West African nations who are present on the ground, although not as engaged in the fighting nor as numerous as the Chadians are. This has been a discussion that's gone on for some time. It has to be said that throughout this discussion, and going back a year now, throughout this discussion, it's always been assumed that the French or the United States or someone else was going to have to provide the air support, some of the intelligence, and some of the logistical capacity that generally African armies lack. So it's always been assumed there would be some role behind the scenes for outside powers who have more sophisticated weaponry and capacity in terms of logistics, transportation, etc. The West African forces who are present are present mostly symbolically at the moment, as I say. There is a sense that those forces might increase in number and that other neighboring nations might get involved, notably Mauritania recently has expressed, the possibility of being involved under UN mandate. And so there is the possibility that eventually a West African force would take over from the French. The question there is largely about the training of those different units to work together in some integrated command structure and also about their logistical and transportation capacities. So it's not something that would happen in the very short term. It would take a while for the training and the elaboration of the structure to actually take effect.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, but you mentioned the United States in there as a possible partner to provide certain logistics. But so far, the U.S. has been pretty wary to get involved in Mali for obvious reasons. I mean, there are certain echoes there that they're worried about in terms of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, for example. What can the U.S. do, and why has it been... is there anything they can do that you think would satisfy how gun-shy the United States administration has been to get involved in Mali?
Well, I think there's a couple things that are very important, and I'm glad you asked that question. The first thing is to understand the U.S. is already and has been deeply involved in Mali in terms of military training of the Malian army over the last decade, particularly in the context of what was called the Pan-Sahel Initiative, as part of the broader global war against terror rhetoric of the George W. Bush administration. So the U.S. has been involved with training the Mali military for years now. The U.S. has been involved diplomatically very deeply in Mali in trying to bolster democratic forces and trying to encourage civil society and trying to bring about some greater development. Also, in terms of the Peace Corps, the U.S. has been very involved in Mali over time, and it's been one of the biggest U.S. contingents, one of the biggest Peace Corps contingents has always been in Mali for years and years now. So there's all kinds of different U.S. involvement in Mali going back some time. Most of that hasn't worked out very well. As we can see, the military training didn't work out very well. The person who led the coup had military training. Many of the Malian officers in fighting right now have U.S. military training. But in terms of the tactical capacity on the ground, doesn't seem to have paid off very well in facing either the MNLA fighters or the Islamist jihadi fighters. So the U.S. has been involved. It hasn't had great results to date. My sense is the U.S. administration is very happy to see France take the lead militarily. That is far preferable to them than to have the U.S. be more directly involved, although the U.S. is offering logistical support, particularly in refueling for the sorties that the French are flying over northern Mali. The U.S. diplomatic effort continues. There is a little bit of complexity there. Many of us from the outside, that is outside of the U.S. government, feel that the State Department is on the wrong path, that they are pushing for rapid elections in Mali. And that this is likely to be a mistake. We feel that it would be better to delay the question of elections in the South, to allow the government to better establish itself, and to avoid holding elections in a period in which so many people are displaced and therefore would be disenfranchised. And we feel that for Mali to move forward and to be able to rebuild a kind of national community and a greater democratic culture in which people are involved in their government, elections need to happen at a time when people are back home, when the internally displaced and the refugees have been able to return home, and when people in the north can participate just as much as the people in the south can participate. We feel if we have elections soon, if the Malian government pushes for elections soon, as is being pushed by the U.S. to do, and also by France to do, many people will be disenfranchised, and the deeper political problems actually will be papered over rather than resolved.
Well, Gregory Mann, we only have about 1 minute left. Could you quickly tell us about your talk that you're giving at the University of Illinois over the weekend?
Well, thanks for that question. There are a number of people coming into University of Illinois to talk about peacekeeping in West Africa. They're going to talk about Rwanda, Senegal, the Congo, and a couple of us, Susanna Wing and myself, are going to talk about Mali. I was going to talk about the external dimensions of the intervention and the history of the intervention, how France got involved, why France has been involved in very different ways over the course of this conflict. Others are going to talk about the process of elections in the South and the political conjuncture in the country at large. The point is to build a dialogue about peacekeeping and West African capacities for peacekeeping and conflict resolution going forward. Mali is just one of the examples, but obviously perhaps the most pressing right at the moment.
Well, Professor, this has been very illuminating, and we really appreciate you taking all this time to speak with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Gregory Mann is an associate professor of history at Columbia University. And again, March 11th, he'll be here at the University of Illinois for the conference, Peacebuilding in West Africa. Thank you so much for joining us here on Focus. Coming up on the show tomorrow, it's been 65 years since the U.S. Supreme Court case McCollum versus the Board of Education made the Vashti McCollum of Champaign one of the most notorious atheists in the country. We'll talk with filmmaker Jay Rosenstein about his award-winning documentary, The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today. Ken Paulson, president and CEO of the First Amendment Center, will also join us. We'll talk about the case, its continuing implications, and the now famous phrase, separation of church and state. You've been listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580. Our producer is Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft gives us technical direction. You can find podcasts of Focus on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus and can hear rebroadcasts of the show on WYLL AM 580 at 8 p.m. every weeknight. If you have an idea for the Focus program, we want to hear from you. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580 and send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And of course, if you want to re-listen to episodes of the show, check us out online, will.illinois.edu. I'm Chris Berube. Jim Meadows will be back again tomorrow. Thank you for joining us on Focus.